Welcome to Education, Technology, Society, a podcast about education in the digital age.
Welcome to Education, Technology, Society, a podcast about education in the digital age.
Hello and welcome to Education, Technology, Society, a podcast where we talk about things to do with digital education, education technology, but from a more critical perspective than is often the case. Now, one of the growing trends in the area of education technology over the past 5 years has been this compulsion by governments around the world to ban phones from classrooms. The latest country to do this is the UK. So in this episode, I talked to Jack Reed from the University of Exeter about the UK government's recent moves in this area. Jack was one of the co-authors of a March 2024 article in Post-Digital Society and Education with the title of Post-Digital Young People's Rights, a critical perspective on the UK government's guidance to ban phones in England schools. So he's the ideal person to catch up with to find out what's going on in the UK. We talk about the recent government push to ban mobile phones from schools in England. Jack fills us in on the motivations of UK politicians, why mobile phone bans need to be seen as a human rights issue. And we also talk about the benefits of using post-digital thinking, post-digital approaches to thinking about digital technologies in schools. This is a topic that refuses to die, so it does merit our attention. And we pack a lot into the 20-minute conversation, so there's plenty of food for thought. I hope you enjoy. I'm generally quite happy to get up to speed with what the UK government is saying, because it's guidance. They can't mandate stuff, but I mean, what is their guidance?
Yeah, so it is guidance. It's not statutory. And essentially what they say is that every school has a duty to try and create an environment that is calm, safe, and free from distraction, so that all pupils, whatever their background, can learn and thrive. That's the kind of generic approach that they take. But then they do build and say that one of the most significant challenges in educational settings right now is the presence of young people's mobile technologies, and that these mobile technologies create distraction, disruption, and diversion. And then they kind of go on and they've got a set of key recommended approaches. So there's almost a sliding scale, really. So schools are recommended to possibly take a no mobile phones at all approach. So young people can't even bring their phones with them to school. So just phones are left at home and that's it. Another approach that's recommended is that the mobile phone could be handed in on arrival and young people don't get their mobile technologies at all throughout the school day. The others is that it could be left in a school locker, but then also, and this is an interesting one, that a mobile phone is just never used, seen or heard. And so young people can still have their mobile technologies on their person, but through the use of effective deterrents, mobile technologies are just not seen at any point during the school day.
So we're kind of turning a blind eye approach.
Yeah, well, a little bit, isn't it? And then there's also a set of recommended sanctions that schools can impose on a young person if they do have their mobile phones with them or do use their phones. And that primarily focuses on confiscation, so taking a young person's mobile technology away from them, and kind of broader disciplinary penalties. So a head teacher can decide to take a phone off a young person for as long as they like. There is no sort of set time. So that's an interesting thing. And also young people can be searched for their mobile technologies in relation to a school's behavioural policy. So there is now guidance on how to search a young person for their phones. And it does suggest that a young person might have two phones and so on and so on. So yeah, kind of trying to at least provide some level of guidance to schools on what to do, I guess.
Which is fascinating because it's 2024. Phones have been in schools for a long, long time. Most schools, I guess, have worked out what to do a long, long time ago. So, I mean, is this guidance seen to be useful by school leaders and teachers, or is it really kind of political grandstanding and point scoring? I mean, why do you think the government is actually doing this now rather than 5 years ago?
So before I started my postdoc, I was working in a further education college. I was teaching sociology. And certainly in the staff room, you know, there was real ambivalence towards young people's technologies, which is really interesting. But the UK government are kind of building on some UNESCO data, so from the Global Education Monitoring Report. And they're saying that UNESCO are saying, well, actually, mobile phones shouldn't be in the school at all, which is not really what UNESCO say. UNESCO actually say that phones should be used only when devices can support learning outcomes, which is kind of the approach that I was trying to take in my teaching as well. And so it's almost kind of reframing some of this data from UNESCO, which is quite an interesting thing. But they also draw on the viewpoint of parents. So they draw on Parentkind's National Parent Survey, which was suggesting that up to 44% of parents are increasingly concerned about the amount of time that their children are spending on electronic devices, and that this rises to around sort of half, 50% or so for secondary school children. So the UK government are also looking at that data, sort of the parental perspective, and making decisions based on that.
I mean, there's so much to unpack there. I'm fascinated. And there clearly is a demand for this, and it clearly is a hot topic. And the misreporting of the GEMS report last year, I think the only main headlines it made was this spurious idea that it was calling for a ban on phones, which wasn't what the report was saying at all. There's so much other great stuff in that report that just got glossed over, because all people wanted to talk about was banning phones. So it is a thing. And the whole idea about giving schools a mandate to search students as well, I think, is really, really interesting. I mean, I know you've not looked specifically at that, but in your journal article, you take these issues and you run with them in some quite interesting theoretical directions. And in particular, you try and develop a post-digital interpretation of all of this, which I think is fascinating. So, I mean, just before we get into the weeds, for the uninitiated, what's your working definition of post-digital? And what does it kind of add to this discussion about phone bans?
The post-digital was the theory that kind of underpinned my PhD thesis. And I first came across it in 2020, and it had first sort of been discussed in its more kind of modern sense, I suppose, in a journal article in 2018, written by Petar Jandrich and colleagues. And essentially what they're trying to sort of outline is that we are now in a society where we cannot necessarily escape the digital. We are in a more and more digital society. So the post in post-digital doesn't mean that we are beyond digital. It simply means that actually we are just unable to escape the realities of technological architectures, our mobile devices. And actually, when we think about our day-to-day lives, the post-digital is always there in some way. You know, we just cannot escape it, whether that be going to the shops or whether that be doing our banking or whatever it might be. Everything in some way or fashion is backed up by the digital environment. And something that I've kind of taken that to mean really is in relation to entanglement. And entanglement is kind of discussed quite a lot in relation to post-digital literature. But really, I quite like that because it suggests that we can no longer reasonably expect anybody to disconnect from the digital environment. We might be able to disentangle ourselves, and that needs to be quite a purposeful and careful process. But we are entangled with our mobile technologies, with our social media networks and so on, to the extent that, yeah, we can't switch them off, which I think for young people, that's really important, and really important, especially in relation to this kind of blanket ban on taking phones away from young people. So yeah, that's the post-digital, I guess.
I mean, it's fascinating. But this idea of entanglement, you said we can disentangle ourselves, but I guess the post-digital idea of disentanglement is a bit more nuanced than most people would assume.
Absolutely. And there's actually a really interesting little blurb, actually, in Kathy Burnett and Guy Merchant's text called Undoing the Digital. And I've just got it here, actually. Maybe I could just quickly read it, because I think it does give an idea of what entanglement actually means.
Yeah.
They say, message alert. I click on the icon. It's almost as if I don't have a choice. Look what came up in my memories. Pictures of my granddaughter stroking the cat. They have been lovingly curated by Facebook. How can you forget when your phone remembers better than you do? I roll my eyes, resenting the intrusion, and then my screen flashes with a reminder. Meeting Kathy, 4:15 p.m. Traffic moderate, travel time 50 minutes. I may be a slave to my smartphone, but at least I won't be late. And I think, so I quoted that in my PhD, and I quite like that quote. But really, it does give us a sense of actually, okay, these technologies are entangled with our lives, but they aren't necessarily an intrusion. I find it interesting when they say that they resent the intrusion, but I think actually, I mean, the Facebook memories that I see come up all the time, and it's like, oh yeah, I remember that time from 12 and a half years ago or whatever it might be. And so I don't think we can necessarily switch it off, but I think what technological entanglement does refer to is complexity and the recognition that we are in a complex relationship with technology, and that these affect various aspects of our personal lives, of our society, maybe even of our environment. And so it becomes deeply intertwined with our social and cultural, economic, ecological systems. And essentially that sort of reframes and shapes our reality on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. And I think it's always interesting to think about what technology does for people. It's not as simple as kind of just being addicted or just being distracted. Now, of course, when we look at the mobile phone bans through that lens, the UK government stance seems a little bit out of step. And you describe this in the paper as structural epistemological ignorance. Now, I mean, can you explain that in a little more detail? Because that sounds like a damning critique. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I guess it is a damning critique in some ways. So, for the uninitiated, I've taken structural epistemological ignorance from Linda Martin Alcoff, who was writing back in the kind of mid-2000s, and she was outlining this epistemology of ignorance in relation to three types of epistemologies of ignorance. And I was particularly drawn to this structural epistemological ignorance in the sense that what it means is that there are prevailing ways of knowing and forgetting, crucially, that are constructed by the socially dominant group. And so in this case, with the phone banning guidance, we could definitely position politicians and policymakers as the dominant group, and that because of the ways in which they are shaping existing data in terms of then trying to create this narrative of this is why we're doing this, it does create this sort of ignorance towards knowledge. But it is in a structural sense, because it is informing the day-to-day lives of young people, day-to-day lives of teachers and school leaders, and it constructs this narrative of power. The structural epistemological ignorance has also been used in relation to colonial studies, certainly in relation to race and racism. And so taking it into the technology discussion, I think, needs to be done with caution. And we try to do that in the paper. But for me, as I was reading through and trying to get my head around some of these discussions, it did make sense in relation to young people's sort of having their mobile technologies banned and removed, and thinking about the power structures that are inherent in the ways that these policies are being enacted.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not that the government are ignorant and don't understand the technology. They understand perfectly well the power structures and the need to discipline students and everything else. It's a really nuanced way of looking at it. Now, you identify risks of phone bans. You kind of seem to be not necessarily convinced that we need phone bans. And you make this argument that it's hindering young people entering post-digital working lives. So, I mean, just to be a devil's advocate for a minute, do you really think that? Because, I mean, school is only 5 or 6 hours a day. So how disadvantaged are young people going to be by not having their phones in the classroom?
I think that question raises the bigger question of, well, what is the point of school in general? And what I take schooling to mean is that the schooling environment offers structure. But that structure then leads into the development of skills. And I'm not necessarily convinced that young people's sort of passive engagement with mobile technologies and broader social media architectures are necessarily going to build the foundational skills that we might need to be able to drive forward a technological society and a technological economy. And so I think there is definitely a need for specialist training. And I think sticking our heads in the sand when it comes to young people's mobile technologies and saying, nope, you're not bringing your phones to school today, really isn't going to be able to drive forwards these ideas of leveling up and so on. I think really there's an opportunity here to develop a more purposeful approach that, first of all, helps young people to understand the technological environments that they're in and some of the dangers that can be present in those environments, but also to help underpin the economy and develop a workforce that can go forward and drive the UK economy in a time where we know that AI and so on is going to be increasingly prevalent and important.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we see this in Australia, where the phone bans only cover government schools. So the independent fee-paying sector, those kids can bring the phones in as much as they like and have all the benefits from it as well. And arguably, it's a lot more than just work skills as well. It's citizenship skills. It's learning just to kind of live with a phone and also having opportunities to just do different things and learn how to engage with the technology differently. If it's not in the classroom, it's not. I mean, that's the argument that we've taken in our own work. I mean, you frame this in terms of young people's rights, which is, again, is a kind of laden word. I mean, what does a rights-based approach bring to these conversations about technology and education? Is technology a rights issue for you?
I guess the short answer is, I think, yes, it is a rights-based issue. And I guess the question I ask myself is, well, what if technology is not a rights-based issue? What are the issues that could arise from sort of saying that? But in the paper, we were sort of thinking, well, actually, young people's rights in relation to the digital environment are protected by the United Nations, especially in the updated comment in 2021 in relation to digital environments. And so the rights of young people are actually really clear. They have the right to access their mobile technologies, especially when that's in relation to accessing community, learning, culture, so on. But also, when a young person's technology is withdrawn from them, that is only legal when it is outlined in a country's law. So interestingly, the English approach is not statutory guidance, so it's not lawful in the sense that there are no lawful underpinnings to it. So it is just guidance. And so the question that we were raising in the paper is, well, actually, is there a lawful precedent then to take a young person's mobile technology away from them? In a statutory sense, I would say that it's not legally binding, and so therefore could represent a breach of a young person's right in relation to the digital environment.
I mean, you have worked in further education. I've never worked in school, so we've never really had to kind of deal with this on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you offer some alternatives to phone bans, suggesting, you know, we shouldn't see it in terms of banning phones or not banning phones. We should have phones around and, you know, listen to young people's voices. Sounds great on paper. How would this actually work in practice? I mean, what can schools practically do if they take your work seriously?
This is the hard thing, isn't it? Is just in terms of academia more broadly, is taking some of the theoretical and conceptual elements of our work and thinking, well, how on earth does that apply to even just one school and all of the different complexities that can come with that? And so I think there needs to be a more relational approach towards young people's mobile technologies. I think we need to recognize that they are entangled with these networked architectures, that we cannot reasonably expect to just take a young person's phone from them. And so I just wonder, and I'm sort of shooting from the hip, I suppose, is whether each school needs to kind of create phone guidance with young people. So to kind of create a democratic process that works alongside the students and says, well, actually, we're thinking about sort of these phone banning guidance and so on, but what do you want? What do you want this to look like? And I think that taking young people with you in those conversations is actually really important. So yeah, it's a complex area, but I think we need to take young people with us here, because otherwise it's going to certainly restrict learning outcomes. It is going to affect well-being. And is that what we want our education to be? I'm not sure it is.
No, I think working this out with young people is certainly the way forward. Lots of other people talk about trust. It would be good to have an element of trust. And I also quite like the idea of young people giving their phones to the teacher rather than the teacher taking them off them. You know, young people can actually decide, actually, we don't have our phones for a bit. We'd rather not have them. But make it, as you say, much more relational, much more democratic. Now, I mean, there's lots of work that could be done on this. Your paper is kind of conceptual rather than empirically based. But I mean, you finish the paper by saying much further work is required, yada, yada, yada. Just to start us off, what sort of work would you like to see researchers now getting involved in? This is a big issue. I think this really should be taken seriously. So, I mean, what further work would you like to see other people do, or do you want to do yourself?
It really is a big issue, isn't it? And I think a research question that would sort of focus on something like, what are young people's perspectives on mobile technology bans in schools? I think that's certainly from my reading, that kind of study, at least in maybe a more kind of qualitative sense, hasn't really happened. And I think that there's a really big opportunity there to work with young people and to sort of prioritize young people's perspectives. I think that would be really interesting. And I think that could also build on Susan Herring's work on the exoticization of young people's phone use, and this kind of adult-centric perspective on young people's mobile technologies. And I think that's what's underpinning a lot of some of these discussions in relation to phone banning. But I think we do need to actually almost reframe the research process and put young people at the heart of that. And so methodological approaches like a narrative inquiry or relational methodologies that include young people in the research design process could also be really important.
Excellent. Well, it's nice to think that that type of research could and should get funded. It's definitely important stuff. And the paper's excellent. Good read for everybody. So thanks ever so much for having a chat. I look forward to seeing what you get up to next.
Amazing. Yeah. Thanks for having me.